This weekend starts right after this.
Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, Geico makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. Geico.com. Easy.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Workers quitting at a high rate. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
As pandemic restrictions lift, the percentage of us leaving safe jobs for new opportunities is at its highest level in more than 20 years. We'll explain what's driving it.
On the personal finance front, the handful of the biggest money decisions that everyone faces at some point in their lives.
How some Americans are getting more competitive about picking up trash. Hear about the Litter League in Pittsburgh.
And TV viewership of women's sports is on the rise.
The women's national team, dramatically won a few years ago. They've done it several times now. But I think the most recent World Cup victory really propelled the notion of women's sports and investing in women's sports. And
Bill Shea at The Athletic on one of the brighter sports subplots from the pandemic. Well, Michigan and Minnesota both had ample opportunities to push out vaccines through professional healthcare settings and into the arms of patients. But in the race to put shots in arms, Michigan lost. Its vaccination rate lagged Minnesota's, exacerbating a late pandemic spike in cases that killed 2,500 people. Minnesota supercharged its healthcare system, dispersing doses to a wide network of doctors' offices and hospitals across the state. Michigan, in an effort to equitably distribute vaccines to rich and poor alike, steered doses to public health departments that aim to entice uninsured residents to max vaccine events. Not only did Michigan trail Minnesota's overall vaccination rate through the end of March, it didn't do any better at vaccinating Black and Latino residents. It's a story by Alessio Bayak, senior data reporter at USA Today. Alessio, what have you looked at?
States started getting allocations, and then they had to make the kind of tough decision of how they were going to push that vaccine out. Right? What kind of providers are you going to use to get those shots into arms?
Okay, so explain the different strategies that the states used and what it led to. Because as you point out in the story, neither came through for the neediest residents.
Yeah, it was a case of both states obviously relying on pharmacies, as we all know. Maybe we've called pharmacies in the last few months to try to get a shot, but also hospital systems, the healthcare system, and public health departments. And so using a combination of those kinds of providers, you're trying to vaccinate your residents, right? The issue becomes in reaching the neediest or the most hard hit by the disease. And so the story kind of gets into how, despite kind of best intentions or trying to go after certain communities and certain, say, counties or zip codes, that doesn't necessarily mean that those people are going to line up for a shot.
Right. All right. So the apples to apples comparison here is what, kind of given the makeup of the two states?
Well, right. So the state's obviously different in population size, but for the healthcare system, for instance, they're relatively the same in terms of per capita. So the same number of hospitals and doctors and rural clinics per capita. That's one thing. And investment in public health infrastructure per capita as well. So, and of course, they're two kind of upper Midwest states, and they're two states that gave us all of their vaccine records for the COVID-19 vaccine. So what that looked like is every day at every location, so say a hospital in Minneapolis or a hospital in Detroit, we can see how many people they vaccinated and on which day.
I'm speaking with Alessio Bayak, senior data reporter at USA Today. His piece is called Michigan Bet Big on Mass Vaccine Events for COVID-19. It didn't work out as hoped. What does Michigan say in its defense as you compare it to Minnesota here?
Well, they said that it was a decision that they they based on what each of their regions, right, each of their counties and localities could handle and, or were equipped with, right? And so they pointed out that, of course, in some rural areas of that state, there weren't necessarily hospitals and a system they could rely on, and so that's where they would go for local health departments. You know, Minnesota told us, you know, similar things about their rural areas, but instead of going for solely local health departments, they were going after clinics and doctor's offices in those regions to try to kind of expand the network, right? Kind of add nodes to your network out there. And it seems in looking at the data that they were able to, Minnesota was able to push a lot more doses through those nodes, right, through those doctor's offices and clinics, whereas Michigan wasn't pushing vaccines through that, through those kinds of offices until much later in the rollout.
Wow. So Michigan here was trying for equitable distribution of vaccine shots. Did it wind up hurting the people more than it was trying to help?
Well, that's what one of my sources said, and that's quoted in the piece, and then many others that weren't. And you know, that's an issue that actually Minnesota doesn't get off, you know, scot-free either, because, you know, whether you're going through hospitals and clinics and doctor's offices, in the case of Minnesota, you're going through mass vaccine sites and public health departments, in the case of Michigan, both of those strategies are kind of going to, they're going to go after the folks who have the most time and the ability to line up or call and get an appointment. As we all remember from this spring, how tough it was to get a vaccine, how many phone calls we had to make or times we had to log into the internet. So both of the strategies we found actually didn't do too well for a lot of the more needy residents, right? A lot of the folks that had transportation issues, access issues, internet, obviously, and maybe even language barriers, right, to getting those.
Thanks, Alessio. Alessio Bayak, senior data reporter at USA Today. Coming up next, workers quitting jobs at a significant pace.
This is a metaphor for your business's journey. Sometimes it feels like the world is throwing everything it has at you. And to succeed, you need someone to guide you through. That's what Dell Technologies Advisors do. They have the tech advice to help you navigate whatever challenges you're up against and get you safely to where you want to be.
For advice on solutions like XPS 13 laptops powered by Intel Evo platform, call an advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. More U.S. workers are quitting their jobs than at any time in at least two decades, signaling optimism among many professionals while also adding to the struggle that companies face trying to keep up with the economic recovery. Here to explain the trend is Lauren Weber, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Lauren, take us through this.
The share of Americans that are quitting their jobs went up to a record high in April. The Labor Department has been looking at this data since around the year 2000, and right now about 2.7% of Americans are quitting their jobs. That was in April. That's up from about 1.6 a year ago during the pandemic. So clearly there's a lot of people ready to make a move.
Wow. And the reasons are what? The pandemic was just a wake-up call? This is like, you know, almost the way some people have a near-death experience and reinvent themselves?
There are a lot of reasons, and that's one of them. I would say there are a few buckets. One is that quitting was really suppressed during the pandemic. People were kind of clinging to whatever jobs they could. Job security was felt kind of hard to come by. So people weren't taking a risk on a new position. So there's a certain amount of pent-up demand. People are now ready to leave behind jobs that maybe they would have left last year had there not been a pandemic. Another interesting thing that I found was that a lot of people got a chance to try out new skills or learn new skills during the pandemic, and often that meant digital skills. Many people moved to working from home. They had to do whatever they were doing previously online. More and more of it was online. They were learning new technologies, and a lot of people found they had a facility for that. So that might have opened up career options for people, especially into a career like technology where there's a lot of job opportunity. So if people found they had an ability there, it was a good time to try to market that and make a career switch. And then for others, and I think this has been discussed elsewhere, you know, there is a way that a certain crisis or a sense of emergency can really make you reconsider what you're doing with your life and think about, well, is this all there is? Is this really what I want to do? So for some people, there was just time on their hands to really think, you know, maybe I want to try something new and recreate my life.
And because there seems to be plenty of opportunities for people to try this reinvention or change in career paths, does that mean employers are forced to raise wages to either pick new people up or retain the ones they have?
Well, we're seeing that in the macro data. Wages are going up, and that's both as employers try to retain the employees they have, but also as they try to attract more people off the sidelines to fill open jobs. You know, there's all kinds of things that some of the companies I spoke to are trying to retain people. They're trying to promote people more quickly, realizing that people might be restless and ready for a change. They may be offering incentives. They may be offering stock grants, different ways to try to breed loyalty and create that sense of this job is too good for me to leave right now.
Mm-hmm. Speaking with Lauren Weber, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. She's got a good story entitled Forget Going Back to the Office. People are just quitting instead. You opened the story with the tale of Edward Moses. What was his example? What did he go through?
Well, he actually was very lucky in that he found a job at the very beginning of the pandemic. He had been laid off in February 2020 before the pandemic really got going. And then he found a job as doing IT help desk work at a software company. And he thought he was going to be part of a team that was going to be providing IT support for employees in about four different offices. But the company, like so many others, ended up going through a wave of layoffs pretty soon after he arrived. He managed to hold on to his job, but it meant that he was doing the work of a few people on his own, and he just got burnt out. And that was another reason why people I spoke with said that they were moving on. I think people felt underappreciated. Companies were reluctant to give raises last year, partly maybe because they were just concerned about what was going to happen with the economy and with demand, but also because, you know, companies are often reluctant to give raises. So he had kind of had it, and so he started looking for jobs back in the fall, had a few interesting opportunities, and what he really wanted to do was move out of doing IT help desk work and become a technical writer, which used some of his other skills. And he did eventually find a position doing that, and he's very thrilled about it. That was another thing that I found was a real positive of this. I mean, obviously, turnover is a huge headache for employers. Yeah. They now have to fill positions. Sometimes it interrupts their operations. Sometimes they have to pay more to attract people. But for individuals, this is a really good time for people to find something that's a better fit for them. You know, and that's really the positive side of the story. When people are in a job that works better for them, often they're paid well, it suits their talents, it suits what they need in their personal lives, which has become more and more important for people, I think. And it also makes them more productive because it calls on all of their skills and abilities.
Thanks, Lauren. Lauren Weber, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Coming up next, the rise of TV viewership for women's sports. This is pretty sobering. Every 10 seconds, someone becomes a victim of fraud or ID theft. And even worse, 23% never recover their money. If you think it can happen to you, that's what they're counting on. But now, there's Aura. Aura is all-in-one protection from identity theft, financial fraud, malware, scam sites, and more. And Aura alerts you to fraud and threats fast, like if your online accounts or passwords were leaked or if someone tries to open a bank account in your name. It's a new type of security service that protects all of your online information with one simple subscription. Aura is easy to set up, and all plans come with $1 million in identity theft insurance to help recover your stolen funds and experienced U.S.-based customer support that's got your back. Right now, Aura is offering our listeners early access and 3 free months when you visit aura.com/Gordon. Go to aura.com/Gordon to get access before anyone else and 3 months for free. That's aura.com/Gordon. It's conventional wisdom by now that the pandemic absolutely clobbered sports, right? Especially television viewership. But they've begun clawing back in 2021. One of the brighter sports subplots here has been strong viewership performances by some women's sports. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
If you build it, they will come. While TV ratings for the NBA, NFL, and MLB may be down slightly during the pandemic, women's sports ratings are surging. What's behind the trend? Joining us now is Bill Shea of The Atlantic. And Bill, did interest in the successful women's soccer teams kick this off?
I think that's one of the key factors is, the women's national team, dramatically won a few years ago. They've done it several times now, but I think the most recent World Cup victory, really propelled, the notion of women's sports and investing in women's sports and beyond the field, the court, the pitch, into other things, endorsements and things like that really began to take off even more than we've seen in the past.
How did the popularity of the WNBA grow starting last year?
Well, it's the league, that league began back in the late 90s. There were actually two women's pro leagues. The WNBA had the NBA backing. It survived. And it's gone up and down in its popularity over the years. But it really took to the forefront, I think, with the national conversation on anti-racism and social justice. And the WNBA was in the vanguard on that, and that has appealed to a lot of people. I know a lot of prominent athletes and male athletes and celebrities have endorsed and been vocal supporters of the WNBA, and their various efforts, and it got a lot of attention outside of just the basketball world, and people are interested. Whether that interest is sustainable, we will see.
More recently, the NCAA Women's College World Series had incredible ratings. What was behind that popularity?
Well, number one, you've got Oklahoma is a powerhouse. In Major League Baseball, they're not hitting. In softball, they are hitting. But Oklahoma is just clobbering people. I think it was just a combination of factors. But Game Two had over 2 million people in the championship series of the Women's College World Series against Florida State. And I think the whole 3-game series averaged 1.8 million. Viewers, weekday games, and that was up even over 2019, pre-pandemic when things were normal. They're incredible athletes. ESPN's game production is excellent. They give it serious attention. They put out a good broadcast with knowledgeable broadcasters, and it's a good product, and a lot of people play softball, and more people are realizing these are tremendous athletes, and it's fun to watch.
We're speaking with Bill Shea of The Atlantic. Bill, speaking of ESPN and sister station ABC, are we only seeing women's sports pretty much on these channels, or is it spreading to other channels as well?
They are in different places, and we're going to see them in increasingly different places because, while there is cable cutting and cord cutting and things like that going on, all of the networks have their multiple, sibling channels. And with the rise of streaming, there is just an absolute demand by all of the networks and streamers for content. They have to populate these streaming services and their network and cable and other channels with content, and live sports has largely been immune from the overall declines in TV viewing up until the pandemic when sports, began to fall off, for unprecedented reasons, but are now regaining their audiences. So there's a demand for content, and there is a segment of sports fans who enjoy women's sports.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Bill Shea at The Athletic. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Innovation, resilience, agility. It's how Michigan businesses work together and continue to build the future. Our expertise, talented workforce, and collaborative environment are making a difference now and shaping the future. Join us and make your mark where it matters. Visit michiganbusiness.org/radio to put your plans in motion. That's michiganbusiness.org/radio.
Thanks for spending part of your Father's Day weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, crucial money decisions you'll make during your lifetime. Also, competition in collecting litter. And for Father's Day, the history of the dad joke. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, Father's Day is here. As you may know, gift guides can be problematic because they're written at a specific point in time, right? And time moves on. For example, a gift guide written for Christmas in 2010 will still show up in search results today, even though it's over a decade out of date and the product recommendations are often no longer relevant. But what is also often the case is that the gift buyer punts without putting in much personal effort to the endeavor. Here's how to avoid punting from Rob Enderle, principal tech analyst at the Enderle Group. Rob, how do you see it?
Well, so I was looking at putting together a gift guide, but they're problematic every year, and this year especially so. I mean, you write one of these things, and they stay up forever, and somebody goes back and looks a decade later and wonders if you lost your mind because everything you've suggested is no longer being made. So the other problem right now is we've got huge supplier problems. So writing a gift guide a couple weeks before the event, there's a pretty good chance you won't be able to get anything that I've listed because we've got processor shortages and part shortages cutting across the market, and it's hard to tell what's going to be available even a few days after you put out one of these things. So instead, I decided to look at the process of buying a gift. I mean, you're typically buying a gift, if it's a Mother's Day gift or a Father's Day gift, for somebody that helped bring you into this world and help train you and get you ready for the world. And yet, when it comes to a gift to give them in kind of remembrance of that effort, we don't typically spend a ton of effort coming up with it. We might give them an electronics gadget. We might see something while we're shopping. But we fundamentally don't go through the process of really thinking through why you're getting them the gift, what it is they did for you, and making the gift appropriate for the event. And so what I suggested is you start this process by remembering what this person means to you. What have you done together? What memorable events have you accomplished together? What things have they helped you with throughout your life? And then crafting the gift around those concepts. And so you're giving them something more of yourself than something you just went out and bought, didn't put a lot of thought in. It might very well be that the gift is just an agreement that you'll spend more time on the phone with them for the rest of the year, because as people get older, particularly as our parents get older, they get lonely, and as we get older, we have less and less time to spend with them, and so sometimes the gift you give could be something more of yourself. I mean, I was thinking back about the fact that now as I'm getting older, a lot of the people that I would be giving gifts like this to have passed, and I have regrets of not having those deep conversations I should have had while they were still alive, and that might have been the gift that not only I gave them, but actually allowed me to have some closure. So thinking through that aspect, that it's less about the gift, more about the remembering the event and really providing something that connected you to the person in a way that showcased you were grateful for all the effort that they put in on your behalf.
I like the idea of take a favorite tool or something that you might have used on a project together and have it engraved.
Right, you take a tool and have engraved. Almost any trophy shop can do the engraving, and you might have helped your dad build a car, or helped your mom with arrangements, or maybe crafting a dress or whatever. And then there were things that you used during that process, and just having one of those things engraved and giving that back to them in a framed or display box would both convey that you remembered and valued that time they spent with you, and give them something that would refresh that particular memory. Because the other thing that happens as we get older, we forget stuff. And it's nice to have somebody come back and remember something that perhaps you forgot, where they felt that you'd helped them out in a very meaningful way. And so now you're that person showcasing the love and care for that parent that you might have forgotten to do and might regret not doing after they passed.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group, talking about Father's Day gifts. I like the what you said in there, too. By doing these types of things, you're also laying the foundation, perhaps, for your own kids.
Yeah, we kind of have an ongoing joke because we've watched as kids grow up that often their children seem to repeat the behavior they had as children. I've got a niece that's got a child that's, absolutely out of control. And strangely enough, she was that way, I guess, when she was a child. and so thinking about the fact that these lessons are passed from, you know, parent to child, taking those loving moments with your parents at least provides a foundation, if your children are watching this, for them to do the same for you. And so it's kind of a way of paying it forward.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. Coming up next, our biggest dilemmas regarding money. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness? We're all dealing with a lot right now. I'm sure you feel the same kind of added stress I do. Then you should know about BetterHelp. BetterHelp isn't a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling done securely online. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. Start communicating in under 48 hours. Schedule weekly or monthly phone or video sessions or whatever works for you. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. That's why there's a special offer for This Morning with Gordon Deal listeners. 10% off your first month. Visit BetterHelp.com/Gordon. That's BetterHelp.com/Gordon. And join the over 1 million people who've taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp, they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. That's 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/Gordon. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Many of the key questions you will face over your lifetime deal with money issues. Good choices can pay off handsomely over time, lifting you up the wealth ladder. Bad judgment calls can condemn you to years of financial struggles. Russ Wiles, personal finance writer at the Arizona Republic, has looked at a handful of the biggest dilemmas that nearly everyone will face eventually. Russ, what'd you come up with?
People sometimes are so obsessed about finding the perfect stock or winning the lottery or some sort of short-term money decision that I thought really it comes down to behaviors, habits, attitudes. If you really want to build wealth and improve your finances over time. And to those points, I think it comes down to making some key decisions about things in your life if you really do want to improve your, you know, financial situation.
Right. All right. So the first one you address is deciding to become a saver. Explain that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you really need to have money that you can invest. And investment is obviously what builds wealth over time. But to get the raw materials for investing, you need to save. You need a surplus of accumulated cash that, you know, income that exceeds your expenses. And, you know, it's really not so much a problem of income necessarily. It's keeping expenses under control. And I think, if people really want to get serious about improving their financial condition, they have to just get into this regular routine of saving.
Yeah. What was the point that the one expert in your story made about buying an automobile?
Well, I mean, yeah, one of the certified financial planners out here, Alan Norris, really kind of highlighted automobile purchases as an example of a big ticket item that can put people in a bind. And it's not only because automobiles, cars, trucks are costly, but often people are using debt to buy them. And these assets will erode or depreciate over time. So, you know, if anything, you want to put your big ticket purchases into things that will maintain their value over time, such as a house.
Mm. How about the point about becoming an investor as part of this?
Well, that would be the second step of sort of that continuum. You need savings to invest. But once you do have it, if you want to be an investor, you know, you have to really look at a few things, one of which is having a long-term orientation in the stock market, real estate market, whatever. And I think you also want to take advantage of the tax shelters that are out there in IRAs, for example, workplace 401k plans, where you might even get matching funds. But you really want to be in it for the long haul. Take advantage of some of the tax breaks. And, you know, assume some risk. I mean, realizing that, you know, you're not in it for tomorrow. You're not worried about whether your stock rises or falls in the next week or month or even year. You're in it for the long haul.
Mm. We're speaking with Russ Wiles, personal finance columnist at the Arizona Republic, part of the USA Today Network. His piece is called Five Crucial Money Decisions You'll Make in Your Life. What was the point about connecting to the system?
Well, that's just kind of a catch-all, but I do think people, if they want to be successful financially, they have to have the right tools in place. And here I'm looking at things like using credit cards wisely, having a borrowing history that allows you to accumulate a good credit score for which you can get, you know, low-priced loans. A surprising amount of people, not a majority of Americans, but, you know, a significant minority of people here don't even have bank accounts, or if they do, they don't use them effectively. You don't want to be paying for things like check cashing or stuff like that. You want reliable banking products that tie you into the system, low fee, and pay your bills, perhaps. And these are some of the ways that, you know, well-off Americans, some of the products that well-off Americans just use routinely.
Thanks, Russ. Russ Wiles, personal finance writer at the Arizona Republic. Coming up next, when trash pickup becomes competitive.
This is a metaphor for your business's journey. Sometimes it feels like you're going 100 miles an hour, barely keeping up. But to cruise through challenges, you need someone who's right there with you. That's what Dell Technologies advisors do. They have the tech advice you need to get past whatever's in front of you and get to where you want to go. For advice on solutions like XPS 13 laptops powered by Intel Evo platform, call an advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL.
Glad you could be with us. Litter collecting contests held for years in some places are picking up, so to speak. New ones started this year in Pittsburgh and Toledo. The efforts begin as part of programs for volunteers to help clean their communities. Then, for some, things get competitive. More from Bob Haggerty, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Bob, what have you discovered?
Well, yeah, people forever have been setting up community groups that go around and clean up trash together, clean up litter. There's an idea that I think the Irish came up with about 60 years ago, and it's gradually spreading around the world, that why not make this into a sport? You know, as long as you're out there in nature having fun, why not have some competition as well?
With trophies and everything rewarded in some of these leagues, right? Referenced Pittsburgh. There's one in, Toledo, Ohio.
Yeah, Columbus, Ohio has had it, New York City, Albuquerque. And, of course, Ireland has had them since 1958.
Right. How does it work? How competitive are they?
Well, it works in various ways, but usually the idea is that people form teams and they keep track of how much litter they have collected, how many bags they have filled in a certain period. And then they sometimes also compete in other categories, such as who has the most interesting presentation or who turns trash into artwork, or there's the yuck challenge in Pittsburgh for who finds the grossest items. But mainly it's about volume.
What typically wins the yuck challenge? I'm almost afraid to ask.
Well, this is the first time it's been held, but I'll leave it mostly to your imagination. One item that's been entered is underwear.
So are the winners judged on total bags of trash collected or total weight? How does it work?
Yeah, the rules tend to be a bit fuzzy, but and I think it would be quite easy to cheat, but most people take a good attitude. Usually they keep track of how many bags they have filled, and then they estimate how much weight that would be. And then they, for other items that don't fit into bags, they estimate the weight of those.
Wow. We're speaking with Bob Haggerty, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He's got a funny story entitled, "One Man's Trash is Another Man's Triumph in the Litter League." I got a kick out of the one guy you spoke to who said his strategy to win the trophy for this is to actually let the litter pile up, right, in his favorite spots.
Yeah, this was a team I talked to. They clean up all year round, but if there's a competition coming up, then they hold off for a little bit and let the litter pile up for a while.
Is this the same guy? He knows all the secret dumping grounds?
That's another secret. Yeah, you've got to know where to find it. You know, along certain highways, people tend to throw a lot of stuff, including large items.
Right.
And another piece of advice someone gave me is if you get obsessed with cigarette butts, you're going to lose because cigarette butts are too small.
Which doesn't mean they don't get picked up, I guess.
Yeah, you can pick those up too, but it's the tires and the sofas and the beds and the television sets that are really going to put you over the finish line.
Thanks, Bob. Bob Haggerty, reporter at the Wall Street Journal in Pittsburgh. Coming up next, the origins of the dad joke. As a business owner, you eventually realize you can't do everything yourself, but hiring is complicated. And what if you only need part-time help? Belay, an innovative staffing solution, has successfully matched thousands of businesses with part-time virtual assistants, bookkeepers, and social media strategists. Belay offers you a virtual support team that can transform your workday. Let Belay help you juggle less and accomplish more. Just go to Belay, B-E-L-A-Y, solutions.com/deal. That's BelaySolutions.com/deal. Deal. Well, for Father's Day, a little history about the origins of the dad joke. NationalPost.com says the first recorded use of the term can be found in a 1987 Gettysburg Times column by Jim Calbaugh. On Father's Day of that year, Mr. Calbaugh not only introduced dad joke to the public, but also made an impassioned plea to keep the genre alive. At the confluence of neutrality yet punchy is where the beauty of dad jokes stand, like, what's brown and sounds like a bell? Dung dung. There's no social commentary, there's no agenda, no political material, it's neutral. Dad jokes often derive their comedy, as you know, from puns, which some say is a lost art. One observer told National Post, it's a genre most kids grow up with and can relate to, no matter where they're from. It requires no cultural know-how and no knowledge of social trends or world updates. A quick laugh, often accompanied by a slight cringe, is exactly what a good dad joke provides. It can also lead to the occasional honor, if you will. For example, did you hear about the dad who invented knock-knock jokes? He won the Nobel Prize. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, GEICO makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. GEICO.com. Easy.